This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the place where you and I get briefed together on the great matters of the moment by folk who actually know what they're talking about. And if it works for you, and I suppose especially if it doesn't, please communicate by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Today, where does this week's excitement leave us on Brexit, apart, that is, from being a week closer to March's departure date? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Bemused, maybe even exasperated, they are...
It's so sad. It's a really, really sad situation, not just for the people in the United Kingdom, but also for us in the EU27.
We've done a lot to help the UK. This withdrawal agreement is the only possible agreement, and we've done a lot of concessions to reach it.
We have spiraled again into a new mess.
If this deal is rejected in the Commons, we are left with no deal or no Brexit at all.
Senior Europeans seeking to make head or tail, Kopf oder Schwanz, tête ou cœur of where, after the last week's histrionics, Britain now is on Brexit. So today, the Briefing Room will try and find out for them, and for you, and, frankly, for me. Step inside. In the Briefing Room with me round the table, I have three experts who are going to help me become clear on all this. Jill Rutter from the Institute for Government, Agata Gostinska-Jakubowska, who works at the pro-EU think tank the Centre for European Reform, and Meg Russell, who runs the Constitution Unit at University College London. But first, a bit of context, historical and constitutional. What useful precedents are there for the situation we now find ourselves in, if any? A little earlier this evening, the historian and crossbench peer, Lord Hennessy, came into the Briefing Room. Peter Hennessy, you've seen a few political crises in your time in Britain. Where does this one rate?
This one's grade one listed. Whatever it is, force 10 on the Richter scale, whichever measurement you choose. It is quite without precedent because of the multiple factors that are involved at the same time, and they all swirl and interrelate one with another. I'm up to seven, I think, swirling crises. Can I give them to you?
Sure.
Well, the European question, obviously, but it's reopened the Britain's place in the world question with a vengeance, which we've been grappling with since Suez. You and I have grown up with that question. We've been interested in it since our consciousness began, really, you and me, haven't we, because we're of an age. Reopened the Irish question, which is the one that's making the weather this evening. It's reopened again. Well, not it was already open, but it's given new force to the very union of the UK question, because if it's a hard Brexit, it will fuel the pressure for Scottish separation and a referendum in the 2020s, and Scotland may well leave, which would be a profound change. It is also what Disraeli might have called a condition of Britain question. The referendum showed up in very stark primary colours, differences in life and life chances across the kingdom. We were a country that no longer knew itself. Our party system is the other one that's being stress-tested because it's left-right, cannot handle the European question. And finally, I would think Parliament as an institution is being stress-tested. Can it fulfil its ancient function of being the grand inquest of the nation? And there will be a eighth one or seventh, I'm losing my fingers here, if we have a hard Brexit, because even if some of the contingency planning is accurate, the forecasts are accurate, it will shake the public's faith in the government as provider and protector in a very serious way, which will be very damaging and very lasting. And when you put those weather systems together, all intermingling and all reacting, one will make the weather one day, another the other. We've never seen anything like it before.
Now, one of the things that interests me about this situation is that, by and large, during my adult life, I have felt that, although it might win or it would lose, the government was in control. This is the first time in my life where I've actually felt that things were happening beyond the government's capacity to control even Parliament. Do you feel like that?
I do. And that wise and good man, Alistair Darling, was talking to me the other day at Westminster. And he said in so many words, I can't put it as eloquently as he did, that the entire British system depends on a functioning government and a functioning opposition, which neither of which we've got at the moment. He didn't say that, but that's what he implied. Because Parliament can't take over the running of the state. For example, it can't negotiate a deal with Brussels as a kind of surrogate to a government that's not managing to do it at all or doing it poorly. And that the whole system depends upon that. And his great worry, which he said he's quite happy for me to talk about to other people, is that the public will lose faith in the system, the parliamentary system. And in an open society, that's really very serious indeed. Now, Alistair's not given to exaggeration. He's also very experienced. So he rather made me rethink a bit my own weather systems metaphor.
Now, talking about previous common market and EU crises, in a sense, there was a feeling that the thing could be settled within parameters, that there were kind of fairly kind of clear-cut decisions, the choices to be made. There were only one or two of them, and so on. And that feels very remote from us now.
It does. Again, it was another Labour friend of mine, Larry Whitty, who's used to negotiations, being a trade unionist, who said to me right at the beginning of the Article 50 process, the difference with this one is, from normal negotiations, when normal negotiations don't work, the status quo just rolls on. Because of the referendum, the status quo cannot roll on. And that makes it qualitatively different from all the previous ones. And in terms of our place in the world, the geopolitical question, it's matched only by disposing of the empire, which we did over 40 years, 45 years, and largely in the control, the timetable of British ministers, not entirely, usually only negotiating with one group of politicians at a time, or would-be politicians, would-be takeover politicians. So that doesn't help us either. I was thinking the other day in a dark moment, I try to avoid the dark moments, but they occasionally fall upon me, that the greatest crisis of your and my shared lifetime was the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that was done and dusted in 13 days. This European crisis, and the clock is still continuing, has been going for 68 years, David, 68 years since the French sprung out of the blue, the coal and steel plan on us in May 1950. And I do think that the least we could do for posterity, for the generations to come, our children and our grandchildren, is somehow in our generation get a settlement that's viable and durable. Otherwise, they'll be cursed with it as well. And it is a curse. It's driven us mad. This most pragmatic people in the world, we like to think of ourselves, are the most mature political system that anybody's ever managed to preside over. Yet we cannot handle it. The European question is the great disruptor of post-war British politics. And my heavens, it's capital D disruptor at the moment.
Now, you make the point that if we hadn't had a referendum, if the thing hadn't been decided by that mechanism, then in a sense, modifying or actually even contradicting what the vote was wouldn't have been that difficult. Parliament could have fulfilled its usual function, government could have rolled out a plan for it. But when you have this sort of break, this thing That's which right. everybody can refer to, you can't work round it.
And if you try and run a system of plebiscitary democracy alongside the representative, you're asking for trouble. Because plebiscitary is primary colours, yes or no, and representative is a thing of subtlety and organic growth and organic adaptation, as you say. And when you think about it, we've been struggling to absorb the plebiscitary result, the referendum result of 2016, into the representative democracy with which we're so familiar, ever since the result came in. And Mrs. May's general election last year was partly an attempt to do that. And the meaningful vote is the latest attempt to try and absorb the consequences of the plebiscitary into the representative. So this creates yet another great weather system.
I want to be clear what you're saying here, which is those of us who might, or those people who might have a fantasy that Parliament can somehow or other wrest decision from the government and create a government for itself, which can somehow settle this, is actually too difficult for us to accomplish.
Parliament can make or break governments, but it can't be a surrogate government. It's not designed for that. It's designed to produce, well, it wasn't designed at all, it just happened in the way British institutions develop. But it's our first-past-the-post system, plus the parliamentary system that we have with the Commons having supremacy over the Lords and all that, usually means we end up with strong executives. It's designed to do that. But it cannot actually do, a legitimate coup d'etat and take over the functions of government. And one of the problems with what we're dealing with is, I think one of the deep illusions that we have, and I share it, I'm a classic example of it, is that we have a kind of genius as a 59th minute of the 11th hour country, that the 59th minute of the 11th hour will suddenly produce a cunning plan of Baldrickian proportions which will get us through. It's alternately called muddling through, and we take great pride in muddling through. But this one, I think, rather does expose the fragilities of all that. And it's a Rubik's Cube of possibilities. There are so many possible outcomes. It's rather like the Suez affair, but stretched over years as opposed to just a few months, because we got over the Suez crisis remarkably quickly. And it's the rolling humiliation of, which was bound to be so when you think about it, because we went to that negotiating table after the referendum as a mendicant, as a beggar, in an asking posture, because it could be no other. And also it was going to be very difficult because nobody had a negotiation like this before.
Professor Peter Hennessy. Agata Gostinska-Jakubowska, you've usually based in Brussels, but you had the pleasure of being here in the last week for our crisis. You heard right at the beginning of the programme, as the news headlines were read, that several voices, the Irish voice and the European voice, about whether or not they could essentially help Theresa May out. Do you think that in the end, the European Union will do something big to help Theresa May get her deal through?
I think that substantial renegotiation of the withdrawal agreement is out of the question. Backstop, which is contested here in the UK, is going to stay in the text of the withdrawal agreement. Having said that, I think the EU27 is ultimately interested in UK is ratifying the withdrawal agreement. So as you heard already, Donald Tusk, the European Council president, but also other leaders said that they would like to help facilitate UK's parliamentary ratification. Now, the question is, what can they do? And it seems to me that there are great limitations to what they can do, because the ball is now in UK's court, actually in Parliament's court. Well, they could definitely reassure Theresa May, but also perhaps her backbenchers as well, that the EU has no desire to lock the UK in the backstop, that it will work towards solutions which will enable to obviate the need for the backstop actually to kick in. But I don't think that Theresa May can get any legal reassurances that the backstop will not be needed.
Well, now, that's the point it all turns around, though, isn't it? Which is, of course, her opponents are going to say, and that's a majority of Parliament, it seems, even by her own estimation, that actually it's the legal thing which is the problem, and you've got to get rid of that. So I'm going to put to you what's often said here, which is the EU likes to negotiate right up until the last moment. It plays hardball, and then at the last second, when it becomes clear that the thing won't go through otherwise, it will give up even on the legal requirement for the backstop. Now, do you think there is any chance of that happening?
I'm afraid not this time. And I've heard it numerous times that, you know, at the end of the day, the EU will come up with a legal fudge. But the EU27 simply cannot afford to give the UK legal assurances that the backstop will not be needed, because that would undermine the idea of the insurance policy being in the withdrawal agreement in the first place, right? So I think you can't really go for any sort of legally binding solution. I know we are talking quite a lot about something similar to, for example, what The Hague received after the Dutch people voted in the referendum against the ratification of the Ukraine-EU agreement. The heads of state or government actually adopted a decision saying, you know, that the association agreement does not grant the Ukrainians rights to move freely in any EU member states and basically work freely. But it's easy to adopt a decision reassuring a member states about something which is crystal clear anyway. It's much more difficult to give any legal reassurances on something which, frankly speaking, depend very much on UK's itself and its red lines that, you know, sort of led us to the situation in the first place.
Agata, thank you very much indeed. Jill Rutter, let's now look through, start the process of looking through the various scenarios. We've heard what Agatha says, and that's her judgment. And I noticed, by the way, that both you and Meg were kind of nodding along to that, so that being your understanding as well. Let's not speculate about what our MPs will or won't support and who's in favour of this and who's not for the time being. Let's just look at what the scenarios would be and then evaluate the problems or advantages of each of them. Jill, you have a, I think you have a kind of almost a taxonomy of them, so take us through.
Well, I'm going to start off with what you might describe as the Prime Minister's dream scenario, which is that maybe she obtains something out of Brussels, some words or something. She then calls the meaningful vote. The meaningful vote passes. Looks improbable, but the meaningful vote passes. Then she does what she also has to do to give effect to that withdrawal agreement, which is that that she brings in a thing called the Withdrawal Agreement Bill, the piece of legislation that takes that treaty and puts it into UK law, and that passes too. She does that all in perfect timing, and we leave, in accordance with the EU Withdrawal Act, in a nice orderly Brexit into that transition on the 29th of March 2019.
So that's the hope, and that's the one thing that we all think, well, people all think won't happen. Meg Russell from the Constitution Unit, there's no great market for that.
No, I mean, if she comes back in January, it looks like it's going to be early January now, with a repeat of the vote, I think there's nothing much to suggest that it will be anything different to the way it was last time round, that she was heading for a heavy defeat. And unless suddenly everybody has a change of heart over Christmas, the facts are basically going to be the same, and therefore the outcome is likely to be the same.
OK, presumably she can see that as well. So, Jill Rutter, she doesn't get enough. The deal's voted down in January, or maybe even not put again, I don't know. What else could happen?
So the next thing that she could potentially do is, in the light of that defeat, she could go back to Brussels and say, I need some changes. There are two parts, remember, of this agreement. There is the withdrawal agreement. That's the thing that agrees how much money we will pay, guarantees citizens' rights. And actually, there's probably quite a wide consensus in the Parliament that we should do both those things. And then there's the famous backstop. But there's also another part of the deal, which is a thing called the political declaration, and that's about the future framework. Quite a lot of people are saying they don't like Theresa May's deal, not because they're so fussed about the withdrawal agreement, and this I think particularly applies to a lot of the Labour Party, but because they don't like the political declaration. You hear people say it's too vague. It's 27 pages of pretty waffly language, a spectrum of options. The Treasury couldn't evaluate it. We need to avoid a blindfolded Brexit. So, for example, Jeremy Corbyn has said what he doesn't like about this arrangement is it doesn't contain a reference to a permanent customs union. Other people are saying they'd like a different sort of long-term settlement, an EEA and customs union approach. Even the DUP might buy that.
EEA arrangement is what Norway is.
The Norway, Iceland and Liechtenstein arrangement. So it means we stay part of the single market and the customs union. So she could go back and try and get some substantive change and then put that back to Parliament.
Meg Russell, what do you think of that? I mean, essentially, that seems to be a way of getting what the famous Norway option as part of the declaration. And I think that means, doesn't it, that the Democratic Unionist Party would no longer object to the deal.
I think there are various difficulties with this outcome. One, of course, is that the political declaration in itself is not legally binding, while the withdrawal agreement is. So if you could win a vote on it, you'd then have to deliver it subsequently. So you'd have to have a coalition that held together for a good long time, because MPs would otherwise be worried that once it had gone through, the government somehow just reneged on it. And once you're talking about this option, you're not really talking any longer about a parliamentary majority which depends just on Conservatives and the DUP, because there are some Conservatives who would like this even less than they like the current deal. So at this point, you really need some Labour votes in order to support what is essentially a softer Brexit, which means that Theresa May, or perhaps somebody else, because it's not very much in her character, needs to reach across the aisle and find some reliable supporters, not just short-term supporters, because they'd have to support the bill as well as a single vote. And that might mean actually reaching kind of over the head of Jeremy Corbyn and finding a block of Labour supporters.
Could that be somebody other than Theresa May? People talk about a government of national unity at this point, which could somehow or other sweep up Labour people and Conservative people.
Yeah, well, I think that there are, this is, it sounds a little bit fantastical. It's a bit wild, but goodness me, you know, as we just heard Peter Hennessy say, we're in uncharted territory here. Things are wild, unexpected things are happening, so you can't rule anything out. I think this kind of method of working is not very much to, wouldn't come naturally to Theresa May to work on a cross-party basis. And I think that might be the point at which she actually stepped back and said, this isn't a job for me anymore. But I think that there are other people on the Conservative bench. She's in the Conservative cabinet, maybe people like Amber Rudd or David Lidington. You could come up with a range of names who might actually be able to build a cross-party coalition to deliver something, which could be a sort of Norway-style deal, or it could be a referendum, which I expect Jill is going to come to shortly.
Well, Jill, come to it.
So another possibility, and of course these are all, there's a really interesting question of how does Parliament actually get the government to do things? Because as Peter Hennessy was so rightly saying, Parliament can express views on things, it can amend legislation, but it's actually can't negotiate and go to Brussels and sit on the other side of the table, whatever. So another possibility is that rather than try to dictate the end state, Parliament tries to dictate a change of process. And that's where I think you're starting to look at, do we bring the possibility of a second referendum? So Parliament could either do that by expressing it when she comes back to the meaningful vote, putting down an amendment saying you have to do that, or indeed tagging that on to the withdrawal agreement bill if we ever got there, to add something in there. So Parliament could say, actually, we can't do this. You have to have a referendum. Or the Prime Minister could say, I'm actually hitting that brick wall. This is no good. I can't get this through Parliament. We're having a real problem with taking forward the result of the referendum. The only way to do it is to go back to the people.
Meg Russell, how would we decide what was in the referendum?
Well, that's not straightforward. I mean, the referendum that most of the supporters of the so-called People's Vote, the People's Vote campaign, have been pushing for, that's kind of been predicated on the idea that we would have a referendum where people were asked to choose between the deal or remaining. We wrote a report on this some time ago, and we pointed out that that might be the most credible question, but the weakness of it is that the deal was too soft a Brexit for a lot of people. A lot of people say it's not a proper Brexit, and they would protest that the proper Brexit wasn't on the ballot paper. We've now got an added problem, I think, with that question, which is that the deal seems to be so unpopular among MPs that it would actually look like a rather strange decision to pit something so unpopular against Remain. And bear in mind that a referendum also requires a bill to pass. You can't just hold a referendum. You have to pass a bill to have a referendum. It has to have the question in it, and MPs would have to support that question.
Jill Rutter.
I was just going to say that the thing about the Prime Minister's deal is it's both soft but vague, and that's the other problem about putting to people. It's basically a prospectus for the next round of talks, and that's an odd thing to put to a referendum as well.
That's because the withdrawal deal is only the precursor to the to the bit that follows. So that then takes us down to the no deal option, which everybody has said, and we've discussed this on this programme with you before, Meg Russell, could be, some people believe, is the default position which you arrive at because all the others have fallen down. Now, Jill, there are even different kinds of no deals, aren't there?
Yes, so it is the default because actually that's what's in UK law. We triggered Article 50, so it's there in EU law. We notified we were going, and it's in UK law in the bill that the Commons, that the Parliament passed in the summer, the EU Withdrawal Act. So that puts 29th of March 2019 into UK law. So the question then is, on what terms do we leave? So the UK government's issued a whole range of preparedness notices. They assume a lot of cooperation from the EU. And that's where you get this idea that could we have a managed no deal that you'd hear. The idea there is, well, the EU would like some money from us, so we could offer to pay a bit of the money, not the 39 billion, but maybe 18 billion or so. The EU would agree, maybe even agree to give us the transition that's currently in the withdrawal agreement to sort ourselves out a bit, and would agree.
That's a period of 1 or 2 years.
So a period for readiness. At the moment, the withdrawal agreement has a transition that runs to December 2020 with an option to extend for another 2 years. Maybe they'd agree that transition. They'd agree a range of side agreements. So planes would keep flying. We wouldn't face all those those sort of pesky customs checks at Dover and things like that that we're worried about. So we would manage out those negative consequences. But that depends on a lot of EU cooperation. Michel Barnier, when he was speaking to the Exiting the EU Committee, said, if you don't like our big withdrawal agreement, don't pretend we're going to do some other side agreement.
Can I put this to Agata very quickly? Agata, sure. Do you think the EU would cooperate in a managed no deal?
I'm very sceptical, actually, about the idea of the managed no deal. And the EU and member states have been actually pretty busy preparing also for a no deal scenario for the consequences of disorderly withdrawal. And one of the communications, actually, the European Commission published explicitly says that member states should refrain from chatting bilaterally with the UK. So the idea of those mini deals is not going to fly.
So disorderly no deal.
So I think there's a sort of a slightly sort of halfway house, which you might call mitigated no deal, where the UK takes some measures. The UK is already thinking of what measures it could take. For example, we're saying that we will recognise EU authorisations because we won't actually have the capability to do something else. What you might see is similar mitigations being agreed unilaterally on the other side. So it won't be as disorderly as it could be, a completely disorganised no deal, but it would still be a patchwork and a pretty messy exit and nothing you could really rely on. And there'll be some real problems because we potentially run into a lot of conflicts with World Trade Organization and things like that, because there'd be big issues about what tariffs would we levy on EU goods coming into the UK? What tariffs would they levy on our goods?
Meg Russell, can I ask you this? Is there any scenario we get to? Because we could also talk about a no confidence in the government, which might lead to a general election or it might not. General election creates time. It might even require a Conservative Party leadership election before it. We don't know. And so on. Is there any scenario that we have which doesn't realistically lead us in the end towards fairly soon wanting to request an extension of Article 50 because we need more time because it's March the 29th?
Yeah, I think that is looking increasingly likely now. And I think when I said when I was last on the programme that MPs really don't want no deal. Now, there are a few of them who do, but the great majority of MPs do not want a no deal outcome. So if we're drifting towards that, they will act. What will they act to do? In the end, MPs can't just vote against things. They are going to have to vote for some positive alternative. But in the short term, they could block no deal, either by voting to revoke Article 50.
Which we've had the ruling saying we can do from the ECJ, from the
exactly
European Court
of
Justice.
Exactly, this week. Now, that would be a very bold act, and I'd say that that would be unlikely in the short term. But the other thing that they could do is they could simply vote to instruct the government to ask for an extension to Article 50. One of the other things that's happened this week is that Leo Varadkar, he repeated it today, but he actually said it on Monday, is increasingly inviting the UK to either revoke or to ask for an extension, which to me is an indication that the EU27 would grant such an extension if it were asked for, and it increasingly looks like we're going to need it.
Agata Kostynska-Jakubowska, is that also your understanding of where the EU would be?
I think if the UK indeed asked for the extension and if that was a genuine willingness, actually, you know, to change the dynamics on the British side of things, then it would be very difficult for the EU to say no. Let's remember that such a possibility is enshrined in Article 50, so you can ask for that, but that also requires the unanimous agreement of all the EU member states. And then, obviously, we have another question, how long such as extension should last, and then we run into serious problems. We will have European Parliament elections. What do we do then? And I think your institute also provided a very useful MEG analysis, saying we would need at least 6 months, for example, to prepare and basically hold another vote. So that brings us beyond Parliament elections.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for now. My thanks to Peter Hennessy, who you heard earlier, to Jill Rutter, to Agata Kostynska-Jakubowska, who you heard just then, and to Meg Russell. We'll be back next week, and until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling, and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or indeed the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do enjoy hearing from you.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.